The next chapter, 12, Gold Spot, begins with a message handwritten on stationery headed Bhagavan Sri Satya Sai Baba. This is the message. You as body, mind, or soul are a dream. But what you really are is existence, knowledge, bliss. You are the God of this universe. You are creating the whole universe and drawing it in. To gain the infinite, universal individuality, the miserable little prison individuality must go. Bhakti is no crying or any negative condition. It is seeing of all in all we see. It is the heart that reaches the goal. Follow the heart. A pure heart seeks beyond the intellect. It gets inspired. Whatever we do reacts upon us. If we do good, we shall have happiness, and if evil, unhappiness. Within you is the real happiness. Within you is the mighty ocean of nectar divine. Seek it within you. Feel it. Feel it. It is here, the self. It is not the body, the mind, the intellect, the brain. It is not the desire of the desiring. It is not the object of desire. Above all these, you are. All these are simply manifestations. You appear as the smiling flower, as the twinkling stars. What is there in the world which can make you desire anything? Signed, with blessings and love, Sri Satya Sai Baba. Chapter 12 begins. After returning home, my first trip to India, I began to feel an inner awakening, as if a once familiar but closed off and hidden center was opening up, and I was becoming reacquainted with a part of myself I had long forgotten. I identified the experience as one of devotion and began to wonder whether such a center lies dormant in all of us, awaiting release through some personal spiritual experience. This awakening, or opening, or unfolding, was a source of great joy, and with it came a deepening feeling of love toward Baba, and for people in general. Was I witnessing something about the dynamics of love that modern psychiatry was not aware of? Nothing was more important than this new reality. I began to pursue with fascination the unfolding of such inner potential. Baba's teachings became a way of life. I became a vegetarian and began practicing hatha yoga and meditating faithfully. In the serenity of meditation, I felt an exhilaration at re-experiencing my closeness with Baba. And I soon came to realize that the only separation between us was a limitation in my ability to concentrate and focus on him, and not geographic distance. Baba has said, quote, "Do not lose contact and company. For it is only when the coal is in contact with the live embers that it can also become live ember." End quote. I tried to stay in constant touch. This change in attitude carried over into my work and social life. As an extension of the meditation, I tried to carry out my daily activities while meditating on Baba's physical form and my experience with him, as if the services I did were an offering to him. I attempted to see him in all experiences, to respond as if they were, in fact, part of him. This was a real challenge to my control and concentration and a marvelous way of patterning my daily experience. Keeping his form in my heart and mind brought me as close to him as I had been in India. I wanted to spend all my time focusing on this magnificent awakening because of the joyful experience itself and also because such attention is encouraged by Baba as a way of bringing one closer to God. The purpose of our life is to realize God, he says, accomplished by bringing him in concrete ways into all of our activities. Quote, "The divine should be expressed in mind, heart, and action, in thought, word, and deed." End quote. This attitude toward life, of course, entails discipline, patience, and perseverance. But when directed to the task by such as Sai Baba with such love and caring, the undertaking becomes a pleasure. Quote from Satya Sai Baba, "In fact, it is the rule and restriction that gives charm to the game of life. If, in the game of football, any player can do anything with the ball, and there is neither foul nor out, neither offside nor goal, neither throw nor penalty, then it will be a meaningless game incapable of giving ananda, bliss." End quote. I begin to see that I must diligently engage in spiritual practice because in large measure I am a creator of my own destiny. Baba put it in this way in a message to American devotees in 1972. Quote, "You as body, mind, and soul are a dream, but what you really are is existence, knowledge, bliss. You are the God of this universe. You are creating the whole universe and drawing it in." End quote. Baba goes on to describe the mechanism or type of spiritual work through which we can succeed in becoming the whole universe. Quote, "To gain the infinite universal individuality, the miserable little prison individuality must go. Bhakti, devotion, is not crying or any negative condition. It is seeing the all in all we see. It is the heart that reaches the goal. Follow the heart. The pure heart seeks beyond intellect. It gets inspired." End quote. The conviction grew in me that all of one's strength comes from contact with and meditation upon God, tuning into God's love by actually becoming the process, vibration, or frequency called devotion or meditation or reverence, by actually becoming God Himself. Could it be that by tuning ourselves this way, as with a radio receiver, we are able to receive deeper messages from the universe, and that we experience the reality to which we are accustomed by keeping ourselves tuned to inferior stations, such as infatuation with sense objects and the constant struggle for prestige and power? In Baba's teachings, I saw the possibility of infinite growth and evolution. Both spiritually and professionally, my work became more alive, exciting, and productive. I found myself more intuitively attuned to my patients while in a meditative posture. Seeing these changes quickened my interest in Baba as a teacher. How could I draw closer to him? Should I treat him as I had treated other teachers? Was the best way to learn by being in close physical proximity and verbal communication with him? Within a matter of weeks after my return, I decided that I had to go back to ask this question of Baba himself. I yearned to return and continue to witness events which I now believed to parallel those of the life of Christ. I knew I was watching the unfolding of a monumental event in the history of mankind. Could I sit at the feet of this great master? Perhaps if I found work in a hospital somewhere in India and he allowed me to visit him regularly. Plans were made for a trip in October 1972. This time my wife, my brother and his wife, who incidentally is my wife's sister, and a cousin were also going. We would join Indra Devi and some 35 other people. I remember that prior to the first trip, my wife and I had been sitting across the table from my brother and sister-in-law at dinner one evening, discussing the forthcoming adventure. Don was quite skeptical. Somewhere, a screw was loose in my brain. I don't remember his comment specifically. Sam, you never catch me dead on that subcontinent. Nothing but poverty, a primitive way of life and disease. And to think that here was this hyper-scientist, a physician, joining me, completely skeptical, but beginning to feel some of the excitement of the investigation, perhaps even the possibility of discovering what had so transformed his weird brother. I had also received a long-distance call from my cousin Jerry, a mathematics professor in the East, whom I hadn't seen for quite a while and who had recently recovered from a rather serious illness. Illness and death have a way of prompting us into thinking about the deeper questions of who we are and where we are going. Is there a God? And what is the meaning of our lives? Looking at the question from a purely mathematical standpoint, Jerry felt it was indeed probable that an avatar might exist at present. Quote, all the stories of such great happenings in the past could not simply be figments of the imagination, he said. They were probably infrequent, but actual occurrences, and because of the similarities of the stories and the historical intervals between the appearances of such great beings, it is highly probable that such an event could happen now. End quote. Lila, a friend of mine, was also going with us. About a year prior to the trip, before she had ever heard of Sai Baba, Lila was admitted to the university hospital for a breast biopsy. As she waited for surgery, fearful and apprehensive, a roommate was kind enough to give her a prayer. She read this just before her operation and felt a great and immediate easing of pressure and a sense of peace. Nothing serious was found wrong with her. Sometime later, Lila and I were discussing Sai Baba, and she became intrigued. She read a book about him and began to consider the possibility of meeting him herself. She was then deeply in debt, however, and there seemed to be no feasible way for her to get the money to go to India. Her husband, Homer, an inventor, at that time had no steady income, and had been unable to sell an invention in 5 years. Yet, as highly unrealistic as the trip seemed, she made plans to go and obtained her vaccinations and passport. Then, some strange things began to happen. Lila, feeling particularly depressed, had an unusual dream. Riding in a car, she looked up to see Sai Baba dancing on the roof of a house, like the fiddler in the movie Fiddler on the Roof. Baba's eyes twinkled, and he was full of fun. He lightened up her spirits greatly. Soon afterwards, Homer hit upon an invention, After a swift and improbable chain of events, some people became interested in it, and his financial situation suddenly and quite unexpectedly improved. The first time in years that this had happened, Lila now had enough money for the trip within just a week of takeoff time, and since she had made complete preparations, she found herself jubilantly boarding the plane with us. There was a strange assortment of people going along on this trip, from those who felt they had supernatural powers to the hyper-scientific, youngsters and oldsters, people attracted to Baba from all walks of life. One older woman, whose diet had been almost exclusively fruits, became ill with abdominal pain on the plane, and I was amazed and amused by the number of healing techniques used on her. There was a chiropractor who twisted her this way and that, and a spiritual healer who said that by drinking water from a cup at a distance, he could heal her by cleansing her insides. There were people who attempted meditation and calling on the spirits, and there was a psychiatrist, myself, who tried to give her reassurance and a tranquilizer. Everyone with his own technique, amidst the groaning and continual discomfort of this poor woman. The miracle was that she recovered halfway through the trip in spite of all of us. After arriving in Bombay and then Bangalore, we found that Baba was in Puttaparthi. So we made our way, 40 strong in a caravan of 10 cars, to the ashram. The distance from Bangalore to Puttaparthi is about 110 miles, and the ride was unusually pleasant and beautiful. A short distance from Bangalore, we passed a deserted airstrip. A sign on the side of the road read, "Caution, watch for low-flying aircraft." I chuckled. All I could see were a cow and a monkey. The drive led us through interesting, busy little villages, hilly country, and large expanses of open space, the terrain constantly changing. Partway through the ride, a rain fell, cooling the air. We finally arrived in Puttaparthi at 6 in the evening. The sun had just set, and the cool air smelled clean and fresh. We approached Prashanthi Nilayam along Puttaparthi's main street, an unpaved roadway filled with people and animals and lined with small shacks. Pictures of Baba were displayed in the windows and fronts of shops. A tall stone wall surrounding Prashanthi Nilayam separated it from the village. We turned left through an old gate and were within inside the ashram grounds. Everyone is excited. From somewhere inside, we could hear the rhythmic chanting of bhajans and knew that people were gathered to await Baba's appearance. We had been told that he walked twice daily among the seated devotees, giving them darshan, the blessing of seeing the Lord. Finally, during these periods, he selects those fortunate people whom he will see later in an interview. We all jumped hurriedly from the cabs and made our way toward the chanting. Imbued with a sense of reverence and devotion, the vibrations gave notice that we were now on holy ground. As we approached the gathering, Baba was slowly walking around a cleared circular area in front of the temple. Here sat some 15,000 devotees, eyes glued to the master. Though directed inward, his gaze seemed to contact and hold all in awe. Once again, I experienced great joy from making contact with Baba. The moment was deeply moving. We stood silently at a distance until he had completed his walk and re-entered the temple. Then some Americans approached and helped us get situated for the night. Prashanthi Nilayam was still in the process of construction. Although dormitories were still being built on the periphery of the ashram grounds to provide living space for permanent residents and visitors, only a few had been completed. Piles of rock and sand were everywhere, workmen creating busy background movement for an otherwise quiet and peaceful setting. An important festival, Dasara, the festival of victory, had just ended, and there were still thousands of people on the grounds, too many for the limited housing facilities. Considering the problems posed by this large group, however, operations were surprisingly orderly. Two large roofed areas, each perhaps the size of a football field, provided some shelter for hundreds who lay on the bare ground at night. Our party was among the more fortunate who were housed in the dormitories. Even so, our situation was quite Spartan. The men and the women were separated, and seven of us were directed to a room about 10 by 12 feet. Those without air mattresses slept on the concrete floor. There was a water faucet available for bathing. The toilet was a hole in the ground. The women, too, were packed into a very small room, but blessed with a sink, an American sit-down-type toilet, it was very attractive indeed. The cultural shock for many Americans on first arriving in India is severe. I felt uneasy even placing my feet squarely on the floor in a bathroom filled with cobweb spiders and unpleasant smells. The sewerage system, I was told, was in poor repair because of the overcrowded conditions and a heavy rain which had flooded some of the drainage areas. Despite the discomfort, most found Prashanti Nilayam a special place with strong spiritual vibrations. Statues of gods, pictures of Baba, and the constant cleaning of sacred areas around the temple contributed to an atmosphere of silence charged with holiness. Many felt their meditation to be extremely high. Baba's presence permeated the ashram. During chanting, one could almost feel his form in the vibrations. Sai Baba occupies just one room on the second floor of the large temple in the center of the ashram grounds. The temple was in the process of being rebuilt, and workmen were forever busy around it and on the roof. In front of the temple was the cleared area where devotees sat awaiting Baba. Although shoes could be worn around most of the ashram grounds, they were not permitted here. Twice daily, about 11 in the morning and 5:30 in the evening, Baba appeared for darshan. As the exact time of his appearances was unpredictable, people generally came early and waited. For most of the Americans, the major activity of the day was to sit around the temple in silence and wait, frequently for long hours in the hot sun. Many who were used to a faster pace became restless. My brother and I had plenty of time to become close. Although he demonstrated tremendous stamina and perseverance, he assured me that before he would consider Baba divine, certain criteria would have to be satisfied. First, Baba would have to change the course of the sun. Second, he would have to stop the flow of a mighty river. Third, create a cow at a distance. And fourth, turn himself into a mountain. My cousin Jerry was eager. He got up the first morning chipper and ready for battle. He would sit by the temple all day, he said, not eating and not wasting a moment's time. Periodically during the day, my brother and I stopped by to see how he was doing. He remained determined, although as the day wore on, he seemed to wilt a bit. At the end of the first day, with no success in meeting Baba, his spirits had dropped noticeably. The second day, one of the men in the room developed a deep cough, high fever, and periods of delirium. He was too ill to leave the room. We had to bring food and care for him. A number of people quickly decided they couldn't contend with these conditions and were going to leave as soon as possible. They would wait only long enough to see Baba privately. At the end of the second day, we learned that he would see us the next morning. We were jubilant. In the morning, the 40 of us crowded into a small room to wait for him. Finally, being in his presence was an exciting change from the tedium of simply waiting. He appears to be in constant bliss. His face and body are lit with an aura of energy that I've never observed in another human being. His movements are brisk and alive, his smile full of excitement. With a piercing gaze, he stood a moment by the side of his chair looking at us, moving a person here and there, making sure we're all comfortable, and then he sat down. This alone filled everyone in the room with glee. With all of us sitting at his feet, he began to speak lightly and jokingly. All of a sudden, he turned to Lila, and in a very sweet voice, recited the prayer that had been given to her a year before when she was in the hospital. He repeated it matter-of-factly, word for word, then moved his hand in the air and produced a large religious necklace or japamala made of 108 crystal-like beads, which he threw to Lila. Now, before the trip, she had told me that if Baba materialized anything for her, she would want a japamala, and had gone on to describe it in some detail. The necklace Baba gave her matched the description perfectly. Lila was stunned. Then she broke into tears. "No, no, you must be strong," exclaimed Baba. "I'll try. I'll try," she said. Baba replied, "Don't try. Do." Then turning to a man, he asked, "What do you want?" The man gave no reply. In his familiar gesture, Baba made several quick little circles in the air with his right hand and suddenly produced a ring with a number of precious stones bordering the setting. Later, Paul, the recipient, said it was exactly what he wanted, that he had described the ring in detail to someone in Los Angeles prior to the trip. It was a perfect fit. Baba spent about half an hour with us during the interview. I felt overjoyed with his attention and love. He said he would see each of us privately in the days to come. Then my cousin Jerry asked Baba to produce something for him. He had bought a cheap ring in Greece and was wearing it on his little finger. He wanted Baba to transform this ring into something else. Baba declined. Jerry felt let down. Baba apparently did not want to be obliging or to prove anything. Jerry decided to leave soon. He couldn't put up with the ashram conditions and was disappointed in Baba for not convincing him more thoroughly of his powers. The primitive living conditions and inconveniences were becoming too much for many Americans. Some decided to leave after the second day. Those who were going would have personal interviews the next day, and Jerry placed himself on the list. There was a strange contrast between Baba's magnificence and the stark physical setting where all this was taking place. It was easy to become disillusioned from the physical discomfort. The evening before Jerry's departure, Donald, Jerry, and I left the ashram and walked down Puttaparthi's main street to our favorite eating place, a small establishment, little more than a hovel, but with the distinction of having the only refrigerator in town. Bottled carbonated drinks, including Coca-Cola, were served here, and the drink we usually ordered was called Gold Spot, a bottled orange drink. Since we were wary of the water, we drank mostly Gold Spots, eating the cookies and ice cream there, and an occasional banana. This particular evening, we were bushed from the heat and all the sitting. In a rather downhearted mood, we strolled lethargically down Puttaparthi's main street, dodging cow dung and other animal droppings. Our mood was further lowered by an encounter with a couple of beggars along the way, a deformed child and a man with cerebral palsy who dragged himself along the ground, a begging cup dangling from around his neck. What a physical setting to be in when just 5 or 6 days earlier We had been in the middle of American metropolitan areas, smothered with material wealth and comfort. We made our way to the refreshment stand, seated our weary bodies around the table, and ordered a gold spot, bananas, and cookies for each of us. As the proprietor, an unobtrusive, dark-skinned man, wrapped from the waist down in a plain white cloth, walked to the back of the stand, a horde of buzzing flies rose suddenly from the orange juice squeezer. We congratulated ourselves for having chosen a bottled beverage. The conversation quickly began to reflect our frayed mood. Nearly 12,000 miles from home, Donald and Jerry not only began to examine their own sanity, but quite seriously decided that I should get myself into intense psychotherapy as well. Oh, how I chuckled. I knew the magnificence we were observing, though we were in the illusion of being in pain and privation. But at a time like this, what could I say? How great a sway emotional and physical discomfort have on the balance of our state of consciousness. This imbalance happens to me frequently. I'm amazed at how I can be tricked by emotions, even though realizing what poor reflectors they are of reality. When something like this happens, I vow to myself to detach more from my feelings. But soon, I catch myself being overwhelmed by them again and can only mutter, "Well, here we go again, Sam. I hope you get out of this soon this time." Baba speaks of the trap of the senses frequently, and I know it will take a lot of spiritual work to detach from them. The next morning, Donald and I waited in the sun outside the temple, watching the people who were leaving that morning go in for their interview. I prayed for Baba to do something nice for Jerry. He was yearning so deeply to have some glimpse of God, and I knew what peace and meaning faith would bring into his life. We waited for the better part of the morning. Then all of a sudden, many of the people began to depart, beaming. We began to gather stories. Baba had been beautiful as always, so fully giving, with all his energy of love and protection emanating from him. For some, he had held his hand out so that people could see objects dropping from his palm. We searched out Jerry and found him in an unusually bright and receptive mood, his face radiant. He said that he didn't know quite what to make of his interview yet, but he was glad now that he made the trip. Somehow, the interview had made it all worthwhile. He even appeared to lose his bearings a bit. A woman in the party asked for someone to help her carry her bags, and he quite spontaneously volunteered. "I never do this," he said. "I must be losing my mind." Baba had brought him into a private room and begun speaking to him. But conversation was not what Jerry wanted. He pleaded again with Baba to do something with the ring and took it from his finger. Baba said this was not his wish. Jerry continued to plead. Finally, Baba put the ring in his hand, blew on it, and returned to Jerry an altogether different ring, which nevertheless fit perfectly. This had obviously shaken him. Still, he wasn't completely convinced that the whole thing wasn't just a magic trick. On the other hand, how could he explain his great sense of joy and excitement? He needed all the security and familiarity of home to reflect more deeply on his experience here. For my wife, brother, sister-in-law, and myself, it was more waiting in the hot sun. We became increasingly irritable from the crowded sleeping conditions, the disagreeable bathroom facilities, and our growing grubbiness. Arguments began to spring up among us,
and our emotional control was being vigorously tested. The young man at the far end of the room continued his coughing, fever, and frantic trips to the bathroom every few minutes. My brother and I became more and more reluctant to use the hole in the ground, and finally attempted to contain our regular bowel activity entirely. Their luxurious, Western-style bathroom aside, the women, too, were having their problems. As crowded in their room as we were in ours, they were even finding it difficult to dress themselves. They were attempting to dress Indian fashion in saris, but had difficulty keeping them wound around their bodies. They appeared to be constantly involved in the activity of raveling and unraveling themselves in a frustrated attempt at comfort. Living next to them was a beautiful Indian woman by the name of Uma, the wife of a Delhi physician, who was marvelously kind and helpful. She had a most beautiful voice, and each night the women were treated to Indian music and her exquisitely sung bhajans. She also told them stories of Baba's magnificence, which deepened their feelings toward him. I was greatly impressed with the gentleness and kindness of the Indian people in general. They were extremely helpful to us at the ashram, inquisitive about our American style of life, and filled with deep and humble reverence for Baba. India is the grandfather of spirituality in the world, and the religious flavor is everywhere. One evening, Donald and I visited the small hospital on the ashram grounds. I was telling him that I heard that one of the workmen on the dormitory construction project at the ashram had recently fallen to his death. Sarcastically, Donald asked, "I wonder what Baba did then." "Perhaps there is no better place to die than in Baba's presence," I mused aloud. "He probably received his just reward by meeting Baba on the other side." My brother just shrugged and laughed. We had been together almost continuously, the men staying together in one area and the women in another. The hot sun seared a bond between us. We walked around dazed, shabby, and uncomfortable for close to a week. The chapter ends with the following quote from Satya Sai Baba: "Do not tell me that you do not care for that bliss, that you are satisfied with the delusion and are not willing to undergo the rigors of sleeplessness. Your basic nature, believe me, abhors this dull, dreary routine of eating, drinking, and sleeping. It seeks something which it knows it has lost: shanti, inward contentment. It seeks liberation from bondage to the trivial and the temporary. Everyone craves for it in his heart of hearts, and it is available only in one shop: contemplation of the highest self, the basis of all this appearance."